From the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, I am Kenny Hauser, Nurse Practitioner, Nurse Midwives, AANP Education Specialist, and your host for this edition of NP Pulse, the voice of the nurse practitioner. Welcome to NP Pulse, AANP's official podcast, bringing unique nurse practitioner voices and expertise on issues that matter most to NPs and to our patients. As always, be sure to subscribe to this podcast, share with your colleagues, and check back often for new conversations with nurse practitioners and healthcare leaders from across the nation. Nurse practitioners in primary care and gastroenterology practices must be aware of exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. In this unaccredited podcast, expert faculty Kim Carnes and Amy Stewart outline the roles of NP in identification, testing, and treatment for EPI, epidemiology and pathophysiology of chronic pancreatitis, ordering and interpreting tests to identify EPI in at-risk patients, diagnosing and creating a comprehensive care plan for managing EPI, and finally, our faculty will discuss dose optimization of pancreatic enzyme replacement therapies. Two handouts for this activity have been developed, one provider resource on available approved enzyme therapies, and one patient tool focused on self-administration of pancreatic enzymes. Both may be found on AANP's Tools and Resources page in the gastroenterology and pulmonology therapeutic areas. While CE is not available for this activity, I know you will find this information important to your patients. I would like to take a few moments to welcome our faculty, Kimberly Carnes and Amy Stewart. Amy Stewart is a gastroenterology nurse practitioner with extensive background in GI disorders and with a passion for patient-centric, inclusive care. She maintains a clinical practice at Capital Digestive Care in Washington, D.C. Her clinical interests include high-resolution endoscopy in the identification of HPV and anal dysplasias, inflammatory bowel disease, and irritable bowel syndrome. She currently serves as adjunct faculty at Georgetown University. Kim Carnes is a nurse practitioner specializing in adult gastroenterology in Hoffman Estates, Illinois. She maintains membership in the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation and the American Gastroenterological Association. She is the co-founder of MidGut, a professional society with a focus on education, membership, and collaboration among NPs and physician associates, specializing in hepatology and GI disorders. Kim and Amy, thank you for your dedication to patients with GI and hepatic disorders and for taking the time to discuss exocrine pancreatic insufficiency with our audience. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. So excited to be here today. So, Kim, let's get right into it. First, we'll talk about the underlying pathology of EPI in a little bit. But for now, a brief overview. Exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI, happens when the pancreas isn't making enough enzymes for patients to digest their food. When we think about any disease, it's important to know how common this is and how often we might see it. There aren't many statistics on how many people in the U.S. have EPI overall, but lots of estimates about how many patients with certain underlying disease states might have EPI. Understanding the underlying pathology helps us understand why patients with certain conditions are more at risk for EPI. It's estimated that 21 to 94% of patients with chronic pancreatitis develop EPI, and we're going to go into chronic pancreatitis more later. Based on the U.S. Census data, about 255,000 adults and 6,070 children have chronic pancreatitis. 80 to 90% of patients with cystic fibrosis develop EPI. And that's because the pancreas is one of the primary organs affected by cystic fibrosis. About 85% of cystic fibrosis patients have EPI, usually acquired soon after birth. All patients with cystic fibrosis, regardless of age, should be tested. Then there are other conditions as well. So patients with other chronic conditions like acute pancreatitis, 27 to 35% of people with acute pancreatitis have EPI. patients who've had a pancreatic resection, up to anywhere from 10 to 100% of people who have had their pancreas resected have EPI. And then there are different types of pancreatic cancers. So they are broken down into unresectable. 50 to 100% of people with unresectable cancer have EPI. And those that have resectable pancreatic cancer, anywhere from 55 to 89% of people can have EPI. This is usually caused from obstruction of the duct. Then looking at patients with celiac disease, anywhere from 11 to 25% of people with celiac disease have EPI. EPI can present in a small number of patients with celiac disease compared to other diseases, but it does usually resolve after dietetic control. And it should be excluded in patients with celiac disease who remain symptomatic despite a gluten-free diet. And then looking at Crohn's disease. So anywhere from 14 to 30% of people with Crohn's disease have EPI. This can result from disease activity itself with the immune-mediated changes or secondary to medications used in treatment. Both acute and chronic pancreatitis have increased incidence among inflammatory bowel disease patients. And then also looking at diabetes. So patients who are type 1 diabetics, 6 to 57% of them have EPI, and patients living with type 2 diabetes, anywhere from 5 to 50% of people have EPI. So why is it so important to recognize and treat exocrine pancreatic insufficiency? Kim, quick question. Have you seen complications from EPI in your practice?
Oh, absolutely, Amy. And I think, thanks so much for setting the stage. I mean, like, look at all of this patient population, right, can actually have EPI, and especially those high percentages of the patients, especially with the diabetics, right? I recognize that this podcast is for a lot of our primary care providers, but look at that number specifically for diabetics that can actually have EPI. And yes, I have actually seen this in my clinical practice, and I can't wait for us to talk about it more.
So recognizing EPI is important and treating it is important too. This isn't just a disease where people don't feel good. So EPI can result in malabsorption and if left untreated can manifest in other health conditions. It's been associated with high morbidity and mortality secondary to the malnutrition related complications. And because with exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, there can be such a wide range of clinical symptoms, which we'll discuss later, it is important to know when to consider EPI in your patient populations and how to treat it. Early recognition is crucial for prompt initiation of management and thereby decreasing the EPI-related sequelae. So now that we understand the prevalence of EPI and how many patients this could be affecting that we see on a day-to-day basis, as well as some of the common underlying etiologies, let's delve into what the pancreas does when it's working well and when it's not. Kim?
Thanks, Amy. Again, thanks for such a great in-depth review of the epidemiology of EPI and really setting the stage for the importance of our podcast today, right? For all of our nurse practitioner listeners. So for some of us, it's been a hot minute since we've had pathophysiology. So let's take a moment to briefly overview the role of the pancreas. As we know, the pancreas has both endocrine and exocrine functions. And for the purpose of our discussion, we'll specifically be discussing the exocrine functions of the pancreas. So again, the normal role of the exocrine function of the pancreas is secretion of enzymes that help break down fats, carbohydrates, and proteins, and is regulated by neurohormonal signaling through feedback loops. Now, just as a quick reminder, because we talk to our patients about not being able to break down the fats and the carbohydrates, but some of our patients really want to know, so where does that come from? The pancreatic enzymes include amylase, which breaks down carbohydrates, protease and elastase to break down proteins, and of course, lipase, it's which used to break down fats. So as we just talked about, our rumbling in our tummy, right? Talking about exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, let's talk a little bit more about the definition of EPI. So it's defined as a reduced activity in either pancreatic enzyme production, delivery, or activity below the threshold that's required in order to maintain normal digestion. So this is really important when we're thinking about that patient population that Amy just described for all those that more of, I think, the epidemiology that she talked about. So and as Amy kind of alluded to already, EPI results in impaired function of digestion and decrease of absorption of nutrients and is associated, as Amy mentioned earlier, with significant morbidity and reduced quality of life. For patients with EPI, there can be several consequences and complications. So these may include malnutrition and, of course, fat-soluble vitamin deficiency. And again, think about that patient population, right, that we were just talking about. The loss of bone mass. How about growth deficiency in children? Immune deficiency? And again, as we've talked about before, poor outcomes in other underlying conditions. For example, longer hospital stays, lower survival rates, and this is secondary to malnutrition. Amy, does this kind of seem a little bit familiar for some of your EPI patients that you've seen?
Absolutely. So the complications are certainly there and something that we need to be looking out for as well as monitoring appropriately as we think about our patients with EPI.
Perfect. Thanks. So Amy started our discussion with some great statistics about EPI. Now, I'd like to review, again, some of the common causes, which I think Amy's already alluded to. And the reason we keep bringing this up over and over again is because we really want you to put your clinician hat on here, right? Your detective kind of part of what we do as being nurse practitioners. And when we're thinking about, again, our rumbling in our tummy type of patient, we have to think about what are some of these conditions that are commonly related back to EPI. So again, the most common adult cause of EPI is chronic pancreatitis. This ranges anywhere between 30 to 90% of patients. Now, EPI develops usually within that first 5 to 10 years after diagnosis of chronic pancreatitis. The most common pediatric cause of EPI is actually cystic fibrosis, and that ranges anywhere between 80 to 90%. So this is so important, especially for when we're taking history of our patients to ensure that we are checking a good patient history, which we're going to get into in just a little bit. Now, here's a population that we all see, right? Our diabetic patients. And this actually surprised me a little bit, Amy. I think as I was like doing some of the research for this topic that we talked about today is that, you know, 25 to 74% of patients with type 1 diabetes can actually develop EPI. And in our type 2 diabetics, again, this is something we all see. I know we've all seen these type 2 diabetics, right? So let's keep this in the back of our mind. EPI can range anywhere between 28 to 54% of patients. There's a greater risk in those with longer disease duration, insulin use, and of course, glycemic values that are above their targets. Now, there are other etiologies, as Amy also kind of mentioned earlier, that also are common causes of EPI. These include acute pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer or resection, celiac disease, and as mentioned before, inflammatory bowel disease, specifically Crohn's disease. Amy, I know we've kind of scratched the surface here about epidemiology, talked a little bit about how the pancreas works, again, common conditions. Let's jump into the number one reason that we actually see an EPI. Can you tell us a little bit more about chronic pancreatitis?
Absolutely. So chronic pancreatitis, I think, is sometimes hard to wrap our head around, even for those of us nurse practitioners who specialize in GI, let alone different specialties. So let's dive more into it. To be clear, in the next section, we are discussing chronic pancreatitis, as it's important to understand chronic pancreatitis in order to understand why it's an underlying cause for EPI. So if 24 to 90% of patients with chronic pancreatitis have EPI, how many people have chronic pancreatitis? So the diagnosed prevalence is 98.7 per 100,000 adults and 8.3 per 100,000 for children. Chronic pancreatitis is defined as irreversible progressive destruction of the pancreas. This is characterized by inflammation, fibrosis, and scarring. There are some similarities as well as some differences between acute, chronic, and autoimmune pancreatitis. Over time, we have seen a rising incidence, potentially due to a rise in risk factors or more accurate diagnostic methods. Are we actually just diagnosing the people who've had chronic pancreatitis all along? Anywhere from 10 to 36% of patients with acute pancreatitis go on to develop this chronic pancreatitis. And as we've talked about, there is a wide range of people, anywhere from 21 to 94% of patients with chronic pancreatitis who develop EPI. The longer the duration of the chronic pancreatitis increases the risk of EPI, like Kim talked about, this usually happens within 5 to 10 years of diagnosis. Chronic pancreatitis secondary to alcohol use is also associated with a higher cumulative incidence of EPI. So let's talk about why chronic pancreatitis happens. So there are certainly some risk factors. These include genetic as well as toxic or metabolic is the most common. Things like alcohol, tobacco use, kidney failure, hyperparathyroidism, certain medications, and toxin exposure. But there are also autoimmune conditions and obstructive disorders that can lead to chronic pancreatitis as well. And here is a surprising statistic. 28 to 80% of cases are idiopathic. We don't know why it happens. So how does chronic pancreatitis develop? Looking at the pathophysiology of this, we know that it is multifactorial, related to both genetic and environmental risk factors. But Kim, there's this two-hit theory for chronic pancreatitis. Hit one, there is an acute pancreatitis that injures the pancreas. And then the 1-2 punch comes in with the hit two. There is abnormal inflammation that leads to ongoing pro-fibrotic signaling. When you have this chronic pancreatitis condition, EPI develops because there is a reduction in the pancreatic enzyme due to the destruction of the pancreatic parenchyma. There's also a decrease in delivery of pancreatic enzymes and bicarbonate secondary to pancreatic duct obstruction. So now that we know the types of patients that we might be looking for EPI in, Kim is going to take us through how to diagnose EPI and when to think about it for our patients.
Thanks, Amy. So again, as a nurse practitioner, it's so important to set the stage. How often are we going to see EPI? What type of patient population do we have, right? So Amy's done an amazingly great job in explaining that. And of course, reviewing the number one reason that adults have EPI. Now, let's dive a bit further and talk about making that diagnosis, because I think this is where we as APPs can do an amazingly great job. All right. So again, EPI is largely a clinical diagnosis. And I think it's important that Amy and I highlight that a careful workup is really consistent of obtaining a great patient history. And I think this is going to lend a little bit more to when we get into some case studies, but really talking to the patients about everything that we just discussed. Was there ever a history of pancreatitis in the past? Talking really about GI surgeries. This may be a patient that you acquire, you know, 15, 20 years later after having a pancreatic surgery. And for the patient, they kind of may even forgot about it or it wasn't listed in their history, right? So it's really important to obtain a great patient history. Also, with our diabetic patients, making sure you know, are they a type 1, a type 2? Just because they're using insulin doesn't mean that they're a type 1, right, everybody? But also, how long have they had diabetes? What is their most recent A1C? To really get a great patient history. So the next step, of course, is performing a symptom assessment and really asking the right questions. I think AB and I can both attest to the fact that working in gastroenterology, butts and guts are our thing, right? This is what we talk about all the time.
All day long.
Right? I totally agree. But patients may be a little bit reluctant to talk to us about their digestive symptoms. Patients can really be embarrassed about talking about diarrhea, gas, flatulence, very foul-smelling stools, or even admitting to the fact that they're seeing fat floating in their stool. So describing stool in detail is not easy for a patient, but I think our job as clinicians is actually to normalize this discussion a little bit, to actually help the patient come up with creating this great symptom assessment so that this way it can lead to the right diagnosis. And I think that this was where it takes a little time, Amy, I'm sure you can agree, making sure that we normalize discussing bowel habits. I mean, we even have to have books for kids to talk about everybody poops, right? So not only for adults, you know, but for our kids too, we really have to talk about normalizing that discussion with a provider. And again, the main reason for that, and what I always tell my patients too, is this really helps me as a clinician get down to what actually is going on. So again, sometimes breaking down that barrier a little bit is super important. Obtain a good history, perform a great symptom assessment, ask the right questions. And part of this also is learning about diet and lifestyle. Are they avoiding certain foods? Do certain foods trigger symptoms? Make sure that you write all that down. And then, of course, performing diagnostic testing. Let's start a little bit about reviewing some of the clinical presentations of EPI, because we haven't actually talked about it yet. We talked about our patients, we talked about starting our diagnosis, but what does this actually look like when a patient presents into clinic? So Amy, I'm going to have you hop out with me a little bit, but again, I'm going to start off here with, from my clinical experiences, you know, patients can present with a range of symptoms. Sometimes it can be mild, just a little bit of abdominal discomfort or bloating. And then patients can also present with irregular bowel patterns. So they can have diarrhea. They might not have diarrhea, but also they can have what's called steatorrhea, which is sometimes hard to define or even discuss with patients. But a lot of times this is when fat is actually like separated from the stool a little bit and there's fat droplets on top of the toilet. A lot of times patients will describe like when they try to flush the toilet, they can see the fat lobules on the top. But again, that's a pretty deep in-depth discussion about talking about bowel habits. So patients can have steatorrhea. And by the way, it can be with or without diarrhea. Keep that in mind. Weight loss. This is something that I definitely look for. Bloating. Excessive flatulence, and of course, fat-soluble vitamin deficiencies, along with malnutrition. Now, Amy, I don't know about you, but I just named my entire clinic. Bloating, excessive flatulence, change in bowel activity. I mean, this is my entire clinic that I see on a regular basis. So I think that this is where we become detectives, because a lot of these symptoms I just mentioned are pretty common. Amy, what do you usually see from clinical presentation from your patients?
So Kim, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said when you think about the symptoms alone, you're thinking about our entire patient population. One of the things that patients describe when they talk about kind of oil or fat in the stools, one of the things that I use to help kind of figure out is this steatorrhea or not is, does it look like if you dribbled olive oil in the toilet, if you dribbled it right on top of the water, is that what it looks like? Sometimes patients have a really hard time characterizing what they're seeing. So it's okay to ask questions of, does it look like this or does it look like that? And I think knowing those types of questions can really help get the information that we're looking for from our patients. I think in terms of bloating, it's also helpful to know, is this bloating from constipation that gets better when you move your bowels, or bloating that's persistent, bloating that's worse after meals? So really going a deep dive into characterizing more about these symptoms.
Amy, thank you so much for those clinical pearls. I love that olive oil analogy. That's a great one. I like that. I'm going to borrow that. So as just mentioned, we talked about, of course, the clinical presentation of our patients with EPI. And again, there's a wide variety of symptoms. So how do we, of course, then tailor this down as an NP to make this diagnosis? So I would say there's a high index of suspicion for EPI in patients with chronic pancreatitis, recurrent acute pancreatitis, and again, cystic fibrosis, as Amy kind of set up that stage for us in regards to our epidemiology. Now, we also talked about our diabetic patients. So don't forget about your diabetic patients. If there's persistent change in bowel activity, bloating, you know, and again, that steatorrhea, specifically in your type ones, then I would say there's a higher index of suspicion. Now, this is where it becomes tricky, right? I'd say I definitely have a lower index of suspicion for patients that meet criteria for irritable bowel syndrome and or patients who have no evidence of pancreatic dysfunction. And again, this really lends to taking an amazingly great history, asking all about abdominal surgeries, and of course, any of our symptoms that we talked about as well to correlate to help with fine tuning. How are we going to start working out the differential for our EPI patients? So now let's talk about diagnostic testing. And usually with this patients, there's a gamut of testing done ahead of time. But for our primary care audience, what can we do? And I would tell you, if I have a high suspicion, I will start with a fecal elastase 1. And this checks for pancreatic function, right? So it measures the amount of elastase in the stool. And so we know this test, of course, has a sensitivity of about 77% and specificity about 88% for EPI. So this is something that can be checked in primary care. You order a fecal elastase, the patient turns in a stool study, but the key points on this, and this is where Amy and I like to give a little bit of our pearls here, because, you know, unfortunately, we've made some mistakes in clinical practice. I'm not perfect. I've done this for 17 years, but the best way to learn is when you make a mistake, right, Amy?
Absolutely. When you figure out you can do it better the next time.
Absolutely. So with that being said, I will tell you, here are some clinical pearls about checking fecal elastase. You always want to make sure that the fecal elastase is checked on a solid or semi-solid stool sample. So if a patient comes in and they're telling you that they're having diarrhea and the stools are watery, do not encourage them to get a fecal elastase testing while the stool is not formed or semi-formed. Even if a patient's test comes back and it's a little bit abnormal, I do ask them to ensure that the stool was formed or semi-formed. And if it wasn't, Amy, I repeat it. I know that you want to jump in on there. Tell me what you think on that.
And so why is that, Kim? Why is it so important for the stool to be formed? What happens when it's a loose stool? it can be a false positive test on the elastase. So it can look like EPI when it's actually not, if the patient is having watery stool. So that's why it's so important to get a formed or at least semi-formed stool. If you've got water coming out of your bottom, it's going to look like EPI when it's not. So really important key step there for our clinicians.
Thanks on that, Amy. I appreciate that clinical pearl as well for those of us, because again, that's definitely something I've learned in clinical practice over time. If there's a question if the patient had a form stool or a semi-form stool, I would definitely make sure that you repeat the test before you make that diagnosis. And I have done that in my own clinical practice. Amy, have you actually requested a repeat test as well?
All the time. And patients tend to want to do the test when it's loose because they feel like that's when the problem is happening. So I think really setting that expectation management for patients about why it's so important is a key step in this too.
Absolutely. And now another key point is patients will say, hey, can I do this test while I'm on pancreatic enzymes? And the answer is yes, they can. From what I know and using clinical practice, it doesn't always change the test results, right? If you have EPI, you're going to have EPI. And the other thing I want to say is you don't use a fecal elastase to actually determine if, when we get into management, we don't use a fecal elastase to see, is it going to improve if a patient is on pancreatic enzymes? It can be done while a patient is on pancreatic enzymes and will not cause a false positive or negative result with that as well. There is also something called fecal fat testing, which typically is not recommended. And I'll tell you, my patients are not fans when I have them do a fecal fat testing. It's a little bit of a lengthier test. And again, fecal fat just measures more of the fat in the stool, which is diagnostic more for steatorrhea, but again, not specific for EPI. So not completely needed to make that diagnosis. Now, moving through our diagnostics, last but not least, imaging. And I think imaging is important to talk about, and specifically imaging for any underlying pancreatic disease. When I talk about imaging, and I think that this may lend more towards if you're in primary care, do you feel comfortable ordering an imaging of the pancreas? Or is this when you shift and you send your patients to Amy or myself to get a better evaluation of what's going on with the pancreas? But if you are wanting to check the pancreas, I always say a CT scan, it has to be a pancreatic protocol CT. So it needs to make sure that there's IV contrast or an MRI MRCP, right? So it has to have that in there because as Amy clearly talked about, it's about duct obstruction. So you want to make sure you get a good view of the bile duct as well. So I always order an MRI and MRCP to get a great image of the pancreas. Now, is this where I jump to first? No, right, Amy? I mean, what I usually do is if I have high suspicion, I'm going to check a fecal elastase. I actually don't order fecal fat, I'm going to be honest with you. And then if there is not a history of having underlying pancreatic disease, or if they've never had chronic pancreatitis, they haven't had a distal pancreatectomy, then my next step is to look for any underlying pancreatic disease with a pancreatic protocol CT and MRI MRCP combined. Amy, is that kind of how you do your workup?
Absolutely. And I think we do have to be thoughtful when we're ordering imaging studies, right? There is radiation with CT scans and MRIs are expensive. So we don't want to image just for the sake of imaging. But in this scenario, it is important to get an underlying image of that pancreas to see what's going on. I will get into this with the clinical pearls, but I had a conversation lately with another NP at a networking group who said that she has found multiple pancreatic cancers because she diagnosed the EPI first. And then on imaging, we found out, sadly for the patients, the underlying cause of their EPI. So the imaging is an important step.
Yeah, absolutely, Amy, 100%. So moving through our diagnosis, in late 2023, the AGA published clinical practice update on EPI. And I don't know about you, Amy, but I love practice updates and I love algorithms. They kind of help give us some guidance.
It tells us where to go, when to go there.
Absolutely. And so everyone knows there will be a link to these wonderful AGA clinical guidelines on EPI on the podcast, and will also be available on the educational tools as well. So we wanted to ensure that all listeners knew about this practice guideline. And I think it's a great algorithm for EPI because you're hearing us talk and you're like, hey, Kim, Amy, this is amazing, but I want to make sure that I can remember all of these things. It's a great little algorithm. It's a wonderful four-step process. I'm not going to review all the steps in detail because I know Amy's going to review a little bit of management, but it starts off with when to suspect EPI. So our high-risk conditions, again, chronic pancreatitis, acute pancreatitis, recurrent acute pancreatitis, cystic fibrosis, and pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. We talked about our moderate risk conditions. Again, diabetes, hypersecretory states. That puts in there our clinical presentation, diarrhea, bloating, weight loss, steatorrhea, which we've talked about. Now it moves into our next step, how to make that diagnosis. So again, that fecal elastase. If you're like, hold on a second, what was that test that Kim talked about again? What was that thing? Again, fecal elastase, initially done in clinical context of high probability, so that higher suspicion patients, or patients, of course, that have had pancreatic disease. The next step, so your fecal elastase is low, by the way. It's not high. So, and again, there's some breakdown in regards to what that fecal elastase looks like. And I think for all of us, we're waiting for a positive test, right? Actually, if the fecal elastase is low, that's how we know or can recognize, of course, that this patient has EPI. So, and again, there's mild, moderate, severe. The lower the level, of course, kind of it tells us the grading of the EPI. You're going to look for a low level of on your fecal elastase testing. If that happens, then if there hasn't been cross-sectional imaging, move. You move over to then that cross-sectional imaging to make sure that we're looking for any underlying pancreatic disease. And then our next step is talking about management, which I'm going to lend that to Amy. And then that last step, of course, is talking about outcomes, specifically our patient outcomes. So again, a great resource, a great tool. And I know that you are all going to be able to access this from the podcast as well. So Amy, we've talked a lot about diagnosis. Now let's get to the meat and potatoes. Really, let's talk about how to treat it.
So great segue, Kim. What do we do about it? So we've identified our patients who are at high risk for it. We've done the fecal elastase. We've done the imaging. And now we have a clinical diagnosis. So what do we do? So we're going to talk about pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. So this is kind of an overview of these pancreatic enzymes, because the problem with EPI is that there aren't enough enzymes to break down the food that we eat. So in order to manage EPI, we need to replace these pancreatic enzymes that are needed for digestion. Management is oral formulations of pancreatic lipase, amylases, and proteases. These are all of a porcine origin. And when we think about our patients who might have religious diets, so our patients who follow a kosher or halal diet, all of these pancreatic enzymes have been approved for use by the chief rabbi for our Jewish patients, and they're acceptable for Muslim patients due to the lack of alternatives. There is no other way to treat this other than these pancreatic enzyme replacements. So there are two different types. There are enteric-coated pills, and they don't require co-administration of any acid-reducing agent. We'll talk about this more in a second. And then there are non-enteric-coated tablets, which do require co-treatment with an acid-reducing agent. So why do these non-enteric-coated tablets require a PPI, proton pump inhibitor, or a secondary medication to reduce the acid? When these uncoated pancreatic enzyme extracts are used for therapy, the inhibition of the gastric acid secretion is frequently needed in order to avoid acid-mediated lipase inactivation. So we need to reduce the acid in the stomach to get the enzymes where we want them in the proximal small bowel. Now, what about patients who are using the enteric-coated pills who aren't having a great response? And we'll talk more about this later, but in one study, less than half of the patients show a sufficient response to enteric-coated enzyme therapy, and the efficacy of this improves when you add a potent inhibitor of gastric acid secretion. So these patients might have normal or increased gastric acid secretion together with the insufficient secretion of pancreatic bicarbonate to neutralize the acidic pH of the chyme. Whew, that was a lot of words. But clinical pearl here, you can think about adding on a PPI, even in patients who are using the enteric-coated pills, in order to kind of boost response. So there are some over-the-counter supplements or non-prescription formulations. And my patients come into clinic all of the time. So I'm taking these digestive enzymes. One, if you don't have EPI, you don't need them. And two, they are not recommended for treatment of EPI. You need the prescription strength formulas. So what are the benefits of pancreatic enzymes? It improves symptoms. Usually within a day or two of administration, patients start to feel better. And it also improves the digestion. So not only is this an improved quality of life, but improved outcomes for patients. There's actually significant data about reduced mortality for our patients who are treated appropriately with pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. So how do you pick? There are a number of different formulations that we can use. So there are similar potency and effectiveness across brands when the lipase dose is equivalent. So the most important thing is to get an accurate weight for your patient and understanding what their lipase dose is. And then when you have that, how do you pick? Quite honestly, Kim, we see this all the time. A common barrier is, what is their insurance going to approve? And sometimes we choose a formulation based on what is accessible to our patients. So now that we've figured out how to prescribe it, let's talk about how patients actually take this. So administration and dosing, it has to be taken, these pills of enzymes have to be taken every time the patient eats. So this is not only during meals, but also during snacks. And one of the most common reasons for incorrect pancreatic enzyme use among patients is an incorrect prescription that does not include use with meals and snacks. And also in your prescription, giving the patient enough pills to get through a 30 or a 90-day supply for however many meals or snacks they're having throughout the day. A clinical pearl is you can spread the dose throughout the meal. On label is you take a few bites of food, and within your first few bites, you take your pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. If it's going to be a long, drawn-out meal, maybe you're having a tasting menu at a lovely fine dining restaurant, it might make sense to take one pill when you start, one in the middle of the meal, and one towards the end of the meal. But it does depend on how long that meal is going to last. And let's talk about a snack. Who doesn't love a snack? But understanding for patients what a snack means and that they also need to take these pills when they're having snacks, particularly with milk-based beverages, right? So if I think about a milkshake, that counts as a snack, and you need to take enzymes when you're having that as well. So the recommended starting dose, this is all weight-based dosing. So when you have your patient in your clinic, getting an accurate weight on your patient, not asking them to guesstimate from the last time they were on the scale 2 years ago, but actually having an accurate weight. And even clinicians who practice from a weight-inclusive perspective or health at every size, this is one of those times where we do really need an accurate weight for our patients. And explaining that to patients, I think, can be helpful too. For most patients, they need about 40,000 units of lipase during meals, and half that or 20,000 during snacks. So when we think about the normal pancreatic lipase production during meals, it's usually 900,000 units, and 72,000 units is required to prevent steatorrhea. A normal healthy pancreas produces anywhere from 480,000 to 960,000 lipase units per meal for an average of 720,000. Patients might need to adjust their dosing based on the meal size and fat content. If it's Thanksgiving Day and they're eating all day and eating more delicious, more fatty things, they might need to up their dose. Whereas if they're having a really small snack, for example, they may need less, but still need to take enzymes every time they're eating. So we also need to think about when to refer. So when to refer to GI if you're comfortable starting these enzymes in your primary care practice, or say you're taking care of a patient who's had EPI for a long time, but maybe is still having symptoms despite their dosing of their pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. So thinking about when to refer or escalate dose, and this is signs and symptoms of malabsorption. So if they still have vitamin deficiencies, if they're losing weight, if they still have these symptoms of malabsorption, we probably need to increase the dose. And then we talked about how you can add a proton pump inhibitor to improve effectiveness. And this is a clinical pearl that we have learned along the way.
Amy, before we go any further, I just want to comment here because I think for those listeners in the audience, I know that this is a bit in depth, but I think when a patient is newly diagnosed with EPI, really going through and explaining what do we actually see when we're talking about the normal pancreatic lipase production? Because a lot of patients are like, what do you mean I have to take so many pills? Why do I have to do that? And a lot of them actually don't take all of their medications because of the amount of pill burden, which you and I can talk about. But I think setting the stage as to what you just explained, and I know, again, this is a lot of information, but I think we as APPs need to really explain what is normal production of our pancreatic enzymes. And then this, of course, then leads to explaining to our patients when we're talking about weight-based dosing, why they need the amount of pills or the medications that they're taking. So Amy, I just want to comment. I think that that's a really great pearl. And I think that this then lends, of course, to patients having more compliance with their medications as well. So tell us more a little bit about monitoring, Amy.
Great points, Kim. And I think all of us when we explain the whys of treatment, patients are more willing to jump on board. The pill burden of EPI is big. If you think about having to take one or multiple pills every time you eat for the rest of your life, that's not small potatoes, right? But when we take the time to educate our patients and really from multidisciplinary approach so that patients are not just hearing it from their GI providers, but also from their primary care or other specialty providers, everybody is on board of the importance of this. So how do you know if it's working? How do you know if they're getting enough enzymes? So the patients need ongoing monitoring. So you need to check in with your patient 1 to 2 weeks after starting it for symptomatic improvement. And that's to see if you need to dose adjust or also to check in with them. Are you able to take your enzymes? Do you have some at work and at home? Are they accessible to you so that you can take them when you're eating? Of course, you also need to assess laboratory testing. So if a patient has vitamin deficiencies, which we're going to check at baseline at diagnosis, are we taking enough supplements to monitor and are those vitamins coming up appropriately? You also want to consider a baseline DEXA scan for these patients. Because of the malabsorption and malnutrition, osteoporosis is a big risk factor for ongoing and undertreated EPI. And also adherence assessment, talking to your patients, how's it going? What barriers do you have with taking your enzymes when you're eating? How can we work on that together to get better adherence? So Kim, I think this is where nurse practitioners can really excel in educating our patients and taking the time. So now let's jump into some NP tips and tricks for managing EPI.
So before we talk about tips and tricks, I just think it's important to kind of summarize everything that we've talked about. And again, going back to the specific AGA clinical update, when to suspect EPI, those high risk conditions that we talked about, those moderate risk conditions, reviewing that clinical presentation with the patient and asking the right questions. Then we move into making our diagnosis, fecal elastase and cross-sectional imaging. And as Amy just talked about, how to adequately manage our EPI patients, optimizing the PERT treatments. Those are the pancreatic enzyme treatments. They're commonly called PERT, P-E-R-T, in case you see that. Make sure that we also look at vitamin supplementation, which we're going to talk about in just a moment as well. Lifestyle modifications, which I know Amy talked about. We talked about diet as well, but sometimes limiting, looking at high protein foods, but avoiding alcohol and tobacco. Also, I'm going to say the little pearl here, maybe small frequent meals are also a little bit more helpful. But again, that lends into pill burden, needing to take your pancreatic enzymes anytime you have a meal. And as Amy mentioned, ongoing monitoring, which I think this is where we are amazingly great, which are preventative measures, making sure we check micronutrients, making sure if they're a diabetic patient, are we monitoring their hemoglobin A1C? And as Amy just mentioned, a DEXA scan, but a DEXA scan should be offered every 2 years. And now our last part, we're talking about tips and tricks, but also about just the overall improvement in quality of life for these patients. And again, reducing that long-term sequela of that untreated EPI. And as Amy talked about, recognizing it early so we don't have to, as clinicians, worry about the long-term effects and increase in morbidity and mortality for these patients who have EPI. So Amy, I know we've given some little clinical pearls here and there throughout this podcast, but again, I think this is where we as APPs are stellar in kind of communicating with one another about what we actually do in clinical practice. So number one, as I mentioned before, when we're digging into this diagnosis, it can be really scary when we first tell the patient that they have EPI and there's lots of questions. So we're hoping that this podcast will provide you as a clinician with a lot of information, but also we challenge you to ensure that you have patient education to provide to your patients and families in regards to this new diagnosis. As mentioned before, the AGA has clinical practice guidelines, but there is also a wonderful site about patient education and EPI. And I know we, Amy and I, are developing a tool that you guys will soon see as well to utilize in clinical practice. The next thing I want to talk about is breaking down barriers. I think we as APPs have a different discussion with our patients. Our language is different. Break down that barrier because patients may be reluctant to talk about specifically digestive issues, fatty stools, diarrhea, abdominal bloating. But this is what's going to help get to that diagnosis even faster. And again, we need to normalize this type of discussion with our patients. So how about some practical pearls? So when we're talking to patients about their pancreatic enzymes, it's super important to talk to them about proper storage and of course, dosing. Make sure that you tell your patients that the pancreatic enzymes should be stored in a dry, cool place, not in the bathroom medicine cabinet, because that can break down the enzymes. As we talked about before in monitoring, we need to ensure that we check for any vitamin deficiency. And this lends to me too. I do this in gastroenterology practice. I check for the fat-soluble vitamins. I check A, D, E, and K. Those are the ones that I usually check. And then again, I make sure I check that as an index level. And I do that checking again when I'm seeing them on an annual basis. Amy, do you check anything else when it comes to vitamin deficiencies?
Those are the big ones that I check, but monitoring weight is also a key piece of this as well. And in terms of thinking about how they are responding, making sure that their weight is stable. Some patients might actually start to gain weight who had really lost weight within 2 weeks of starting enzymes. So really having that accurate weight also is a big piece of this for us.
I agree, Amy. That definitely helps us, I think, also in guiding our treatment options. And of course, dietary modifications. So potentially talking about a lower fat diet, because again, the fats are the hardest to break down, as we talked about, making sure that we tell them a snack is anything you put into your mouth, especially those milk products. So a milkshake included, scoop of ice cream included. So sometimes I recommend smaller, more frequent meals. But again, that caveat that lends to higher pill burden, needing to take more pills on a regular basis with those snacks. And if available, if I have some patients who are really struggling, I then lean on my dietitians a little bit to kind of help out a bit with guiding with some dietary choices and even helping patients time taking their pancreatic enzymes with their meal. Amy, what else you got for me?
So Kim, I think you brought up a really good point, right? Proper storage of these pancreatic enzymes. So not keeping it in a bathroom medicine cabinet, but also not keeping it in your car. Can't keep it in the console, which can be really tricky for patients because they need to be accessible every time they eat. So helping your patient come up with strategies of how they can have their enzymes with them, but also how they can be stored appropriately as well is another huge piece of this too. If I think about having to carry around pills and take them every time I eat, you have to think strategically, right? How are you going to store them in your purse? How are you going to store them in your desk at work, for example? And really helping patients think about the day-to-day and what this looks like for them.
Absolutely. And speaking of pills, you and I can attest to the fact that sometimes the biggest kind of hurdle that we come from in a clinician perspective is the cost that goes along with these sometimes and just the approval process. And even sometimes when I'm choosing the pancreatic enzyme that is approved by the insurance company, there is still, again, a very high cost that goes along with this. So what I'd like to point out, and I think Amy and I can both say, prior authorizations do happen. Sometimes they have to happen. I have a form letter that I use and I use it over and over again. So I'll tell you, put in the time, make a letter, use references. I talk about EPI and the importance of using pancreatic enzymes for treatment. It is actually the treatment that helps. But the other thing that I think Amy and I both want to lend to and something that we've learned in clinical practice is really going to utilizing the websites for the companies who are making the pancreatic enzymes, because there are patient assistance programs. Leaning on the local representatives can actually help with that in regard to how to get that patient assistance, and even making sure that we tell our patients that there are patient assistance programs. One of my patients came in and just said they stopped taking it because they couldn't afford it, but didn't mention that to any of us as clinicians. So I always tell the patients from the beginning, these drugs can be costly. Please, if there is a cost barrier or this becomes cost prohibitive, you have to let me know because I'm your partner on this journey. We actually need to work together to ensure you get your medications, and I have lots of tools in order to help you with that. Amy, any recommendations on that?
That is huge. And also, as we know, insurance companies change formularies. So the brand that they may have been on for 10 years now is not covered. So reassuring patients that efficacy is the same among lipase units and really be reassuring that we can still get them the same effect that they've had. But knowing when we might need to switch, when we need to ask insurance what their preferred formulary is, can be a key piece. I think having the form letters, having those saved so you're not recreating the wheel every time can certainly be a significant pearl for clinicians as well.
Absolutely. Again, not a barrier, right? If you've already got it written, then you don't have to think about, you know, taking time out of your very busy day, which we all know we have, in order to make this happen for the patient. Because that's our goal. We want best outcomes for these patients. We don't want the sequela BPI. We want to make sure that they get their therapy. So having these, getting to that prior authorization letter, if you've already got it ready to go, then that takes that additional time not out of your day in order to take care of our patients. So Amy, let's wrap it up here a little bit, but let's talk about our own clinical experiences that we've had that kind of led to the audience audience as to how we've actually utilized some of this in clinical practice. You want to go first?
Sure. The patient that I've had on pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy the longest is a woman in her 70s. She had a total pancreatectomy for an IPMN with high-grade dysplasia in 2015. So total pancreatectomy, she has no pancreas. Not only is she now a type 1 diabetic after surgery, but she also is not making any enzymes because she doesn't have a pancreas. She started on enzyme replacement therapy in 2015 post-surgery. And notes from our office in that first visit, I think this is really key here. So need to measure fat-absorbed vitamins to ensure she's on the proper dosing of pancreatic replacement enzymes. She is not having much diarrhea, so I assume it's reasonably adequate currently. But I think that sentence right from the note really sums it up as to why we do these checks and why we do this monitoring. Her weight is something that we also talk about every time. At every visit, she fluctuates within 5 pounds up and down, but she's also been educated of why it's so important to keep an eye on her weight. So it is something that she checks before visits with us, for example. Here's another key piece. She is a patient that has been on one brand of enzymes for a long time. And just this year, her insurance changed formularies. With the formulary, she actually has a lower pill burden. So she needs to take less pills just because of the change in lipase units among different brands. She was incredibly nervous about the change. But in her most recent visit, she says she's actually feeling better on the new brand. And that is probably just because the difference in lipase units, not because of the actual efficacy among different brands. Kim, tell me about a patient that you've had.
For time's sake, I have two, but I think one more lends to our primary care audience. So I have a 29-year-old female who presented to our office as a referral from her primary care doctor because of generalized abdominal discomfort and irregular bowel patterns. So she had already seen one of my GI providers, and the patient at this point in time had come in with more of a diarrhea predominance. You came in with some diarrhea, and we were working her up more for irritable bowel syndrome-like symptoms. She's 29. She had no red flags. She was not losing weight, but just had described overall increase in stool frequency. Her weight had been stable, which was interesting, but more looser stools than anything else. Again, wasn't certain of any specific food triggers, but noted every time that she ate, she just wasn't feeling well. So after her evaluation, and by the way, she had an upper endoscopy and a colonoscopy, she comes in to see me and I start talking to her a bit further. And what I have learned is that she is a type 1 diabetic. She has been a type 1 diabetic since she was 12. She, upon talking to her a bit further, her blood sugars had not been well controlled for the last 5 years and was very reluctant to start on an insulin pump. And recently had been started on an insulin pump and had noted that some of her blood sugars had gotten a little bit better, but were still very out of range. Her biggest complaint to me when she came in was abdominal bloating, and also described this very strange kind of film on the top of the toilet after she had a bowel movement. With that being said, I then ordered a fecal elastase on her, recognizing that this patient having type 1 diabetes had a normal EGD and colonoscopy, which I wasn't involved in that part of the evaluation, but she continued to have symptoms that were not explained. And of course, her upper endoscopy and colonoscopy were unremarkable. So again, this just becomes a being a better detective. Me really asking her about her diabetes a bit more, asking more if it was controlled. How long has she had diabetes? Was she insulin dependent? Was her glycemic index controlled or not? And Amy, when I did her fecal elastase, it was 50.
I bet it was with all those symptoms and underlying diabetes.
Absolutely. Thinking about this right patient, right? And for those of us that, again, primary care, anybody who's listening, this is the type of patient that you do see. So when we're talking about asking them about their general GI symptoms, this patient ended up being diagnosed with EPI. So Amy, this is a newer, I actually saw her about a month ago. So I started her in pancreatic enzymes. And again, before starting her in pancreatic enzymes, we had hurdle after hurdle after hurdle about getting her approved. I ended up working with one of the pharmaceutical companies to get her actually support in order to obtain her pancreatic enzyme. And she recently just started therapy. So we just had a quick telehealth visit recently. And again, her symptoms have actually already started to improve. But this is the type of patient where we as APPs, I think, are phenomenal in diving in a bit deeper.
So I think just to wrap things up, Kim, thinking about what kinds of patients are going to have EPI. You have to have underlying damage to the pancreas in order to have EPI. So this is not going to be in your otherwise completely healthy, no co-diseases, no comorbidities patients who have a little bit of bloating when they get constipated. And I think that is a key distinction that we can make here. Really using those AGA clinical guidelines, thinking about it in our high index of suspicion, as well as putting on the detective hat, like you've talked about, Kim, and really thinking about patients on an individual basis.
Absolutely. Amy, this has been so much fun doing this podcast with you today. Would like to thank AANP for having us do this podcast. So the next time someone presents with a rumbling in the tummy, we hope that the information and resources provided today will help you in identifying, diagnosing, and managing your patient with EPI. We thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you again for your insight and guidance. To our audience, as you consider the information provided, remember you are not required to complete a post-test or evaluation as CE credit is not available. However, if you decide to provide feedback on this or other related GI topics, please go to aanp.org/CECenter, select and add this activity, and the participation code BPIT4. Remember, the provider resource and patient tools are available on AANP's Tools and Resources page in the gastroenterology and pulmonology therapeutic areas. As always, we thank you for choosing NPs and AANP as your source for education on a wide variety of topics. This podcast was produced by AANP Education, sponsored by AbbVie Incorporated.